I happen to be close by, and he asked if he could have a vehicle, be provided with a vehicle, so I loaned one of the our vehicles, and he and his gang motored off to have a look at this. Well, it's a long story. He got into a little bit of difficulty picking up souvenirs when he shouldn't have, and with the police and whatnot, but anyway, it was a great scoop for these fellows. Imagine being right on site when this when this happened, and being able to get right over there and see the evidence and pick up some of the pieces which they shouldn't have done, and so on. But it was a great event in their life. We had another that day and another that night, and I won't take time to tell that story, but there was a very amusing things happened.
Oh, well, can't you tell it? What happened?
No, I think I better move on.
Okay.
One thing I was going to touch on was the frequency with which one changed commanders in the Air Force. I imagine it was much more so than perhaps in the other services. And that was because squadron commander became tour expired after he'd flown a certain number of sorties, and in order to give him some break from the stress and strain of being fired at day after day, we sent him off to do a rest tour someplace. And that was a minimum of 6 months. Mm-hmm. So that there was a fair rotation of commanders. For example, on just after, well, in the early part of July, I've got a little note here that Wing Commander Bolt took over command, B-O-U-L-T, of 180 Squadron. And I had already had a change of command in 98 when Ron Bellerving was killed, when Christopher Paul took over. Christopher Paul took over, and there was an interim commander between Bellerving and Paul for a few weeks. Ken Eager, Squadron Leader Eager, he held the fort while the new commander was coming in, and he, poor fellow, got killed in that time period, too. He got a big fragment of flak right in his chest when he was flying the machine. But Bolt took over, and he was a fine lad. I was very impressed with him. He had been flying out in the Mediterranean. He'd been in Cyprus, and he'd been in Crete, places like that, and he'd fought against the Germans out there in Crete, and he'd been awarded a Greek DFC. Now, the Greek DFC, as a point of interest, is very much almost identical in design to the British DFC. Mm-hmm. It had the same diagonal bar arrangement. Mm-hmm. And when it was, although it was a different color, when a DFC, a British DFC, was faded a bit and stuck up against a Greek DFC, they looked very similar. But the stripes ran the opposite way. Well, Bolt had only been with me about a month, or less than a month, as squadron commander. And he, unfortunately, when we were doing an attack over Normandy, got a small piece of flak penetrated his eye, just a splinter. And, of course, he lost the sight of that eye, and that ended his flying career. But put up a tremendous show getting that aircraft back. You can imagine how painful it would be to have to fly home with an eye in that condition. And he didn't get back to base, but he got back to the south coast of England and made an emergency landing, which was very satisfactorily done. And he had to be replaced, so I had another commander come in there, Wing Commander Edwards, R.I.K. were his initials, Rick Edwards. And again, fortunately, I couldn't have been more pleased or satisfied with that chap. These were Royal Air Force fellows.
Oh, I see.
you having mentioned the monarch, I decided I better tell you this story. When I recommended Bolt for the DFC for the show he put up, getting that aircraft back with his eye all bunged up.
Yeah.
And in due course it was awarded, and he was amongst that large contingent going to Buckingham Palace to receive his decoration. And when he was standing before the monarch, who was the same one we were just talking about a few minutes ago, George
the Sixth.
Yeah. The monarch had a pretty sharp eye, and of course, Paul Bolt had the Greek DFC up, and he had the British AFC. Now, the AFC is another similar style decoration with diagonal stripes. And he was receiving a third stripy medal. And, of course, when the king saw this Greek DFC, his immediate reaction was, here's this stupid fellow who's put up the decoration before I've given it to him.
Yeah.
You weren't really supposed to have it up
before
the monarch hung it on. Is that right? Am I right there?
I think you're right.
Yeah. So he made observation on this. He said, you've got the DFC up there, and you've got it on backwards. And Bolt said, well, I beg your pardon, sir, but, that's not so. He said, before Bolt could carry on, he said, what do you mean it isn't so? He said, I've been handing out decorations here for... He said, I know when the thing is backwards, when it's not backwards. He said, I beg your pardon, sir, but that medal is not backwards. And he said, and they sort of argued it back and forth. He finally got to the point of telling him it was the Greek DFC. I found the monarch was very apologetic and very interested. And he said, you're going to be the most unique fellow in the Royal Air Force. You're going to have three stripy things, one way, one another. And he said, you're going to puzzle all of the people that see you on the street. And that was. That's just by way of passing. Well, we're up to July of 1944, and I have just mentioned in passing that the 20th of July, and we were operating every day, sometimes twice a day. I think I told you about my Norwegian who operated three times one day. Well, it was an intense period. Mm. And it was a great... One has to pay the ground crew a tremendous tribute to keep those aircraft going day after day. And it was a great tribute to the aircraft itself to sustain a lot of flak and so on and be back.
Yeah.
You'd get patched up and you'd be back, and the aircraft would be back on operations in no time at all. That Mitchell could take a lot of beating.
When would a Mitchell have to be, shall we say, withdrawn for a major overhaul under normal, quote, conditions?
Oh, God, I can't even remember that at this stage. No. But if it were, then we had another brand new one come in to take his place, you see. They kept us up to strength.
And
sometimes above strength, so that we wouldn't suffer for maintenance purposes.
Your squadrons will be very much involved, too, I would think, Larry, in this period that I'm dealing with now in my book, the closing of the Falaise Gap.
We were operating in that area the whole time.
Yeah. It's pounding hell out of it.
And then when the Germans were concentrating and bringing troops into Normandy at the outset of the operation, we were busy knocking out the bridges and working on them. The bridges on the Seine got an awful pounding. And then, of course, when they were trying to withdraw, they had repaired bridges and they put up temporary bridges. We were also knocking those out and so on. I was going to tell you about personal experience on the 20th of July. I had had the task of getting this wing night capable. Mm-hmm. And I told you about that in an earlier tape. But I hadn't myself gone out on a night operation. I don't think I had, no. I might have gone out as a passenger to witness the operation. I don't think I had. But on the 20th of July, we had been going tooth and nail, and CO of 98 Squadron came to me and he said, do you think it would be safe for me to plan a squadron outing, I guess is the way you call it, on the evening of the 20th. He said, I want to get the air crew out to a party and the ground crew, and we want to sort of take over one of the pubs and have a night out together.
Yeah.
And I said, well, go ahead. You do that, and I'll try to cover for you. And I had checked with group, and they said, no, I don't think there's anything likely to come up on that occasion. And, of course, as so often happens, they no sooner got off base, and then it was a complete stand down for that squadron. When I was called for a certain fairly limited number of aircraft from each of the squadrons to do a blind bombing run on certain important crossroads that had been under attack during the day, and another important defile had been under attack during the day, and we were to keep up the bombing at night. So I had to, I got this instruction, and I decided, well, I'm not going to go back to group about this. I will detail a certain number from 180 Squadron for 320, and I'll take one of the 98 Squadron aircraft and put together a crew from my wing headquarters staff and go out, which I did. And it was a rough sort of stormy night. That was one reason they had thought there wouldn't be any operations. It was a gusty, dirty night, you know. And it was quite interesting. I'd been getting a lot of bitching and complaining from the squadron commanders and flight commanders about this night flying. This blind bombing technique at night, because he'd compel them in running on their target to do so straight and level for quite a distance. Yeah. And that was just what the German night fighters, thrived on. If you went straight and level for any length of time, and they happened to be in the vicinity, they were coming up your tail at a great rate, and they could get an accurate burst in on you. Well, sometimes we were doing that in the middle of cloud, and that gave us a little bit of protection, but when they were operating on radar, it didn't matter very much whether it's in cloud or not. This particular night, I was running in on the target, and we were in cloud. And I think it gives you a little extra sense of security, mm-hmm. being in cloud, although I don't know why it should, but one is built that way. Is it? And all of a sudden, that cloud begins illuminated with flashes. And again, you're not too sure whether they're flashes from heavy flak or whether they're flashes from cans that are being fired from aircraft behind you on. But you have to plug on, if you're right in that bombing run, you have to plug on and complete your run and get your bombs off. And I remember that very well, the sensation of having those bursts in the cloud. And of course, it's magnified. You get that big flash and the whole cloud seems to light up.
Yeah.
After the dropping of the bombs, and I started to quickly turn away from the target, I was still in cloud. Those flashes still kept coming. I think they were, well, I'm sure now they were heavy flak, but you're never quite sure what it was. And then when I lost altitude quite quickly, and I got down lower and got below the cloud, then of course you have a very startling sight, because you get down quite low. Then all the machine guns, not only the light flag, but the machine guns start firing on you.
Yeah.
And machine guns with tracer ammunition.
Oh, yeah.
Every so often there'll be around a tracer, you see. And you see this wave of, and you may have dozens of machine guns firing, you see. And you have this great wave of tracer fire.
Yeah.
Following you around. It's a very eerie and frightening sensation.
Yes, I'll bet.
However, I got back safely, and landing wasn't too easy because it was extremely gusty and high wind, and I had to make an overshoot. Something I very rarely ever had to do, but, you know, if you don't feel absolutely right about your landing, you go around again. I remember I had to do an extra circuit that night because I'd undershot. Because the wind was so high that I misjudged it. But I came in all right, and I was, very happy to get back and safely on ground.
Wouldn't it be surprising, though, to send you out in that kind of weather, Larry?
It was borderline. Yeah, it was just borderline.
Yeah.
So it wasn't too surprising.
Yeah.
So.
Did you
But a sequel to that, I might mention, that was. The fact that I took that aircraft out was greatly appreciated by the squadron, in particular by Wing Commander Christopher Paul, and he never did forget it. And some years after the war, when I was Chief of the Air Staff, he had a plaque, beautifully illuminated thing, made up, commemorating this occasion, and the fact that I had stood in for them when they were off on their stand-down, Air Chief Marshal, Sir Francis Fogarty, at that time was the president of 98 Squadron Association. Fogarty had been a 98 Squadron in World War I, and he maintained his connection with it ever since. And he came over to Ottawa, and with this framed thing to present to me, and it was making me an honorary member of 98 Squadron Association because of my contribution on that occasion. So.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
I've got a picture from Francis Fogarty handing that to me. Yeah. That's about one of the few photographs I've retained. I had so many of them, I gave them all to the archives before I left Ottawa.
Oh, I see.
And I've got just one or two pictures left, but that's one of the ones that I retained.
You still have the scroll or what have you, do you?
Yeah. Well, now, the summer went on, and we continued to operate it.
Yeah.
Are you past your time?
We have about 15 more minutes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The only one additional thing I might mention before we leave Dunsfold, and that is about the middle of August, I had six Belgian crews, complete Belgian crews, right from pilot through navigator through air gunners and so on, come to join the squadron, because by that time the Dutch were having difficulty through losses and through tour expiry. Of maintaining enough Dutch crews to fill up the squadron, so it was felt that the Belgians were about as close to the Dutch as you can get, and some of them, of course, were Flemish, and they were a good addition. They were a good bunch of chaps. I hadn't had a chance to really get to know many Belgians up to this point, and I think it was very timely that they should come, because my next base was going to be in Belgium, and it was rather a good thing to have a few Belgian boys in your unit, because there were ways in which they could help, and we moved on. Well, all right, talking about moving on, it had been planned in the operational timetable for Overlord that we would move from our bases in England over to the continent perhaps a month or so after D-Day, if the schedule had been maintained, but of course it wasn't maintained, as you know, and things bogged down in Normandy, and we were able to operate quite satisfactorily from the UK, and then of course when that great surge came and the Germans were pushed out of that area and pushed up through France and Belgium, everything happened at great rapidity. The movement was pretty fast, and there really no longer was any necessity for us to move our bases into that southern part of France, as had been the... We were going to occupy the bases as they were vacated by 83 and 84 group. As they moved up with the army, we would fall in behind and take over some of those bases. But as I say, things moved so fast that we were able still to operate from the south of England and Sussex area. Over towards the Port of Calais and over into the targets in Belgium, even with some ease from where we were. It's when things moved up through Belgium and getting into Holland that we were stretched a little bit, and it was time for us to move. Well, about the end of the first week of September, I had a call from Group to say. I think actually it was on the 8th of September, to say that we were going to have to move to bases in France and Belgium, northern France and Belgium, and would I be prepared the next day to meet the deputy, the Sasso, and some of the other commanders at Vitry in France. I was asked if I would pick up the commander of 137 Wing, Group Captain McDonald, and fly to Vitry and be there at 10 in the morning and meet David Atcherley, Air Commodore Atcherley, and two other group captains who were flying in. The runways at Vitry were completely damaged, but they had patched up enough that ground that you could land on the grass strip nearby. If you were lucky, you'd do it without getting in any holes. So, let's see how we attack this. We were very busy on the 8th of September, and we were attacking targets in the Boulogne area and gun positions and so on. And I had an Oxford on my strength there that was supposed to be used by me for communications purposes, but I'd never flown it. And when I flew in that wing, I always flew in an operational aircraft, in a Mitchell. But Mitchell was too hot an aircraft to land on this grass field, which was all bombed up anyway. So I was informed that I should take my Oxford and use it and pick up McDonald, Group Captain McDonald, and take him with me. Well, before that day ended, I had had the Oxford moved out, parked adjacent to the control tower, preparatory to my flying it that evening, because I never flown an Oxford before, and I thought before I picked up McDonald and flew to Strange Field in France, I better have a little bit of experience. So, as I say, I decided I would await the return of the operational aircraft from Boulogne before I flew this thing, and they were getting back in the evening hours, around about 6 o'clock. And when they came in, five or six of the aircraft had been rather badly hit by flak. They weren't in great trouble, but they had been damaged. And one of them came in to land, and he suspected that he had a bomb hang-up, that hadn't completely released. Mm-hmm. And when he came in and landed, unfortunately, he made a slightly heavy landing, and it shook that bomb free, and it came down on the runway right underneath the aircraft, and it exploded. And when it exploded, it was right opposite the control tower, and my Oxford was sitting between the control tower and this runway. It was so close that one expected the Oxford to be severely damaged, and I paid no attention to it. I went dashing off to check with various commanders here and there to make sure that their personnel were all right, and although it was only a 500-pounder, it sent its fragments over quite a territory. Well, fortunately, it took a bit of time rounding this all up, but nobody, not a soul, working in the hangars or working in the control tower, had been injured. It was rather remarkable. The fellows working in the hangars, and these were metal-sheathed hangars, heard all the hail hitting the hangars, but it was high enough up that it went over their heads. It went over the most of the aircraft, too. So,
what about the chaps in the plane? Would they be wiped out?
Yeah, they were all killed, unfortunately. Well, the only injury was to a prize cow that this fellow, Rowcliffe, owned. And Rowcliffe was the chap who owned all of that property that we had built this. And I think I told him that the Canadian engineers came in and they felled all his trees and the beautiful hunting grounds, and we occupied his great big estate, mansions on the estate. He was occupying the bailiff's house, I think it was.
Yeah.
We weren't very popular. His father died of a heart attack when he saw the engineers come in with those vehicles. And he was withdrawn from the army to look after the estate. So I had a very hostile fellow on my hands. He was hostile before I ever arrived to take over there.
Yeah.
And I eventually got him softened up a little bit. And I thought, good God, now I've got to go and tell him that one of his prize cattle is killed and dead. I went over there. Unfortunately, he had enough. He was a miserable bastard, but he had enough feeling for what had happened. And when he heard that the crew had been all washed out, that he didn't make too much of a fuss about his cow. But amazing that with all those fragments and with everybody else escaping, it should be one of his cows. Well, at any rate, let me get on with that story. I wasn't able to do my test on the Oxford that night because it had to be in the hands of the maintenance crew. It had been so shaken up that they had to check it out very thoroughly. In fact, it had jumped up and down off of that parking space from the vacuum that was created above it. And I was really surprised that it was all in one piece, but it proved to be, and by that time it was too late for me to flight test. So I phoned McDonald that night and I said, look, Mac, My aircraft, my Oxford, the only one I've got, has been pretty badly shaken up, and you might be hesitant about flying in it tomorrow. And Max said, oh, well, if your chief technical officer examine it thoroughly with his staff and he okays it, that's all right with me.
Yeah.
So I was a little surprised at this, since he had one sitting in his hangar that was all whole. I said, all right, Mac, I'll come pick you up in the morning. I did, and I fortunately made a good landing. It was my first landing in that aircraft, and he was standing there watching. So we tootled off to Vitry, which is close to the border of France and Belgium, that was a horrible sight when we got over that field. The runways, of course, were completely blasted out from bombing, and the aerodrome itself didn't have many whole areas, but there was a thing marked out with strips that was possible. Unfortunately, the wind was crosswind on, so I had to come in and make a crosswind landing on this grass strip.
Right.
And it wasn't a very great landing, but anyway, it wasn't too bad, and there we were. So we had a conference there with David Atcherley. He was one of the famous Atcherley twins that are very renowned in the Royal Air Force. And he and Wickham Barnes, Pete Wickham Barnes, and I think Leslie Bauer was also there, not sure about that. They went off looking for airfields for the Mozzie. And McDonald and I were given a list of places that actually thought might be suitable for us. We went to places like Cambrai and Mons and Lille and one or two others. And God, they were in awful shape.
Yeah.
They had been used by the Germans, and they had been battered up by the Allies.
Yeah. And
the Germans, in withdrawing, had shattered them. So I was unhappy with anything I saw there. Cambrai was remotely possible, but we had a rendezvous again back at Vitry at mid-afternoon, and I told Atcherley that I didn't like anything I'd seen. He said, well, there's a possibility that Melsbrook might become available to us. Maybe we better go up and see Melsbrook. And Melsbrook was the biggest airfield in Europe at the time. Even the Germans had built it outside Brussels. Just out beyond the old Brussels civic airport or international airport. That had been at Aver in the years before the war, and it was sort of surrounded by built-up area now.
Mm-hmm.
So Melsbrook had been built, and the Germans had hired used forced labor mainly on its construction.
Yeah.
It was enormous. It was huge. But it had been attacked more by Allied aircraft than any other field, because it had several German bomber outfits on it. Even had an Italian bomber squadron there. The Italians had been bombed a good deal by the Allies, and even from the UK. And I think Mussolini felt he had to get something in there to be able to say that the Italian squadrons were bombing the UK. So it was a sad sight in a way, but it had potential, and I could see that was the place for me. I also felt that McDonald was saying the same thing to him.
Yeah.
It wasn't, as I say, certain that it would be available. But the others had come up there to Melsbrook, so just about the time we felt we should be heading back to the UK, actually, it was he was a devil-may-care type of individual, very able chap, and a wonderful pilot and all that. He said, now, why don't we have a look at Antwerp while we're here? And we all looked in surprise at him, because the battle line had been lying right across Antwerp and the Antwerp airfield, certainly a day or so earlier. And we said, well, surely that's a little hazardous to try to go in there. Oh, he said, no, I looked specifically this morning, and the Germans have been pushed out of there, and we'll be all right. We'll be all right. So we took one Oxford, we left the other one in Melsbrook, and we took one and we flew in there. And when we got there, it was the strangest feeling. There wasn't a sign of an aircraft on this field, but yet the field had hardly any bombing. The runway was clear. There wasn't a sign of a personnel. It was just dead. But yet here it was, a major field adjacent to a major city and so on.
Oh,
so we did a circuit, and then we came around. Well, this fellow actually was a clown and a comedian. He had a great voice, you know, you could hear him. And he was an actor.
Yeah.
As we came into land, he imitated, first of all, the German commander responsible for the demolitions of the of the of the base before they withdrew. And he gave a running commentary of the German giving instructions to his men on just how to booby-trap this runway. And they get attracted for the Allies and so on. So all the way down we had this going on. And then he switched from that to the obituaries in the London Times. And he gave a running commentary of the obituaries and then to the Air Ministry. And the Air Ministry scouring around for an air commodore and four group captains to replace those. And then he wound up he went back to the obituary column, and the obituary was not telling about all of his remarkable achievements, which he had a fantastic number, but was telling him about all the stupid things he'd done. And then it wound up with the stupidest of all was trying to land at Antwerp on a booby-trapped runway. Yeah. And he carried it on right down till the wheels were touching. And he said, at this point, the tripwire is cut by the wheels, and the aircraft is about to be blown up. And this moment, we touched down. And by God, there was a crack in the runway, where the runway had sagged a bit. And the wheels hit this far side of the crack, which was a raised portion. Yeah. And it was so timely that everybody was waiting for the explosion. And of course, we rolled on, and we came to rest.
Yeah.
And Wickham Barnes was flying it, Pete. And he braked as rapidly as he could, because he was afraid there might be booby traps further on. And he just stood there. He happened to see a soldier in a ditch.
Yeah.
So he came to rest close to this fellow and pulled his window down and shouted out. And by this time, Batchelor had the back to the door of the aircraft open. Actually said, just thought we'd drop in and have a cup of tea with you, you know. The fellow said he wasn't going to be taken in by any of this smart talk. He said, you fellows are lucky that you're able to think about tea. He said, didn't you see that ME-110 circling the field when you came over? He said, he turned one way, you turned the other, and I guess he didn't see you. That made us feel a little uneasy. And
a soldier in the ditch?
Yeah.
Was the front line that close?
So, I don't know why he was there. I don't know. The front line wasn't that close, but he was there. He didn't know what we were, I guess, and he was in the ditch because of that.
Yeah.
And so he said, he made some further wisecrack, and he said, you better get you better get this old crate out of here. It didn't take much for an aircraft, because it had no defenses at all. It was just a civil machine, So we decided that perhaps he was right, and we piled back in the aircraft and decided perhaps this was no place for us. And Wickham Barnes was in the process of starting up the engines when he announced that there was a lorry coming down the runway, full tilt, with people waving, about a dozen people aboard. So we weren't sure whether they were giving us a warning wave or whether they were giving us a welcoming wave.
Yeah.
So we shut down again for momentarily to find out, and then they came up, and of course it was obvious as they got closer that they were greeting us. And it transpired that this was the mayor. He and a number of his aldermen and some technical people had driven out to see what state the airfield was in. They just happened to arrive at the time we came over and landed. And of course we were the first Allied aircraft to land on the field. We had this take time to get out again, get out of the aircraft, and shake hands all around, great embraces, and so on.
Yeah.
Not very much interchange, because none of us spoke French very well, or Flemish, or whatever one had to speak.
Yeah.
And after all this hugging and waving, we immediately turned around and piled into the aircraft, and there were most crestfallen-looking lot of people.
Yeah.
But we took off, and by God, we got out of there at high speed and low altitude. Old Wickham Barnes had the throttles right absolutely forward, and we didn't go above treetop level all the way back to Brussels. And of course, we felt a little bit naked as we went across that country.
Yeah.
Of course, we landed and
back to
England that night. And about a week later, the decision was rendered in my favor, and we were informed that Malesbrook was to be the base of 139 wing.
Yeah.
It wasn't to be our base alone, because it was crowded. There was a Royal Air Force wing, Mosquitoes, and also they had a Wellington squadron with some special mission operating out of there. they were going to operate at night, so the theory was we are operating by day, they're operating by night, and there wouldn't be too much congestion. But nobody mentioned the fact that it was also the principal base in that part of the world for augmentation of the supplies for the Allied armies in the area. And indeed, there was a constant flood of Dakota aircraft. There were some heaviers, but mainly Dakotas. And we had, on the average, we had 600 Dakota landings a day, over and above all of our operational landings. And this was on grass, too, because the runways were devastated. We had bombed them. The Americans had bombed them, the British and the Canadians had bombed the runways, some of them with 4,000-pound bombs, some of them with 1,000-pounders. And they were in awful condition, and so were the adjacent buildings. But then the Germans, before they left, they had put demolition bombs across the runway at 100-yard intervals. They put three bombs across the runway, and then another 100 yards, they put another three, another 100 yards, so the whole length. Right. So every runway was an awful mess.
Yeah. Crikey.
And you can imagine the congestion, because in order, with all of those transport aircraft landing, you had to have three-ton lorries coming in there in a constant stream to get to get the supplies out. So every time you were taking off, you had a someplace there was going to be a stream of lorries across your bow up there at the end of the runway, trying to get across to pick up all this stuff. So
yeah, we figured out
we're at the end here, and I happened to be—I just finished off with the word. I happened to be the senior officer on base, so I became the commandant of the field as well as the commander of the wing.
Yeah,
and I had therefore had the responsibility for repairing and traffic control. Air traffic control and ground traffic control in that field.
Jeez.
And that was a picnic.
That would be...
Well, that's enough for today.
Okay.
I just...